PX's saloon had a rhythm of its own. There was the lunch crowd, the after-work martini set, then the beef-eating dinner brigade. All that routine changed on the weekend when the bar and dining room hummed from noon to midnight and long after. Evenings near the space by the front window, and all day Saturday, the flow of neighborhood conversation was superintended by Tommy Ryan, the acknowledged unofficial mayor of the East Side, the arbiter of the area's family, business, and moral disputes, a regular at PX's since the speakeasy 20s. He would appear each evening at 7 with his stories and badgering. Around him stood 6 or 8 fellow parishioners, all ears. Jerry Sweeney, in the short story, The Porcelain Tub, found in his collection titled Down Broadway. Welcome to Delmarva today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Jerry Sweeney is my guest today, and we're talking about his latest collection of short stories found in Down Broadway. Jerry is an Eastern Shore writer, but he spent most of his life in and around Manhattan, a time in the post-World War II years when New York was the art capital of the world, and then on into the awakening and life-changing events of the feminist and civil rights movements of the 1960s. Jerry is the author of 7 novels in the series The Columbiad, which traces the life of a family through the 20th century. I might also mention that Jerry is the book review editor for the Delmarva Review as well. Jerry, welcome to Delmarva today.
Thank you, Hal. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And I have to say, I just thoroughly enjoyed the stories in Down Broadway. I think they are just excellent, Jerry. And the writing, as an example, is really outstanding. They're just so well written. Well, Jerry, tell us about your collection of stories in Down Broadway. There are 25 of them in the book. And I have to ask you, as you tell us about the book, I have to ask you, over what time period were these stories, in fact, written?
They were written over a period of about 20 years, Hal. Down Broadway basically stems from my years of living and working in New York, essentially from the 50s through the 90s. The stories are mostly offshoots from the novels I was writing about those years, tag ends of stories that did not go into the Columbiad novels and didn't quite fit. They represent the time in New York when it was really alive and very exciting. These were the post-war years. We were the only superpower left in the world. The economy was booming. The GIs had all returned. Overseas travel had begun to pick up. And New York's industries were doing well. Wall Street was doing well, the fashion industry, the publishing industry, and there was even the rise of television. And it was a golden age, for Broadway, for instance, with Arthur Miller with Death of the Salesman and Tennessee Williams with A Streetcar Named Desire. There was the O'Neill revival with The Iceman Cometh and Long Day's Journey into Night. And there were the great musicals, South Pacific and Kiss Me, Kate and Brigadoon, Guys and Dolls, My Fair Lady. There were lively years. And there were like three schools operating in New York at that time. There was the New York School of Art, all the abstract expressionists, de Kooning and Pollock and Klein and Rothko and people of that ilk, like Frankenthaler. And there was also like the New York School of Poetry. There was Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery and James Merrill and Barbara Guest. And there was even what they called a New York School of Philosophy. Basically, they were revolved around partisan review. People like Irving Howe and Sidney Hook and Philip Roth. They were just very exciting years in New York.
Well, it sounds like it. And in fact, I remember I was in Massachusetts at the time, and that was to some degree my era as well. And most of the plays that you mentioned, I've seen and read a great number of the authors at the time. During the 60s, which were so vibrant, not just in New York City, but in many places. Well, Jerry, you were a salesman, I believe, in New York.
Right.
Tell us about that and when you started writing fiction or writing your Columbiad novels.
Right. Well, I'd always been interested in writing. I think I got the idea from those old movies where you see the foreign correspondents in their fedoras and trench coats. And I thought, oh, that's the life for me. So I was always interested in going into the publishing business. And meanwhile, I was doing a little bit of writing. And then when I was about 20, I started a novel, and it took me 2 years to write it, and it took me 2 years to sell it, and it took 2 years for the publisher to decide not to publish it. So I said, well, I don't think this is my business after all. But I did continue to write, but I really did most of my writing after I retired, when I finally had some time.
But, so you did the larger part of your writing. You retired to the Eastern Shore, and is that when you began
I did.
The majority of your writing?
Exactly. Yeah, and in the early 2000s.
Well, there are a number of stories in Down Broadway that touched me, and one of them is called Lost Souls. And Jerry, I wondered if you would tell us a bit about Lost Souls.
Lost Soul reflects the one out-of-body experience that I had in my life. I was raised Catholic, and as they say, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. And like most kids my age, you know, in parochial school, I had a strong devotion, to the Virgin Mary. But I left the church early on, but always, you know, tried to live the good life, you know, according to the principles of the church. When I was about 50, I was standing in the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. And I felt that like something was ripped from my body, that my soul was being removed. It was a really spooky story, right? Certainly scary, but that was the basis for this short story.
Well, the young man in Lost Souls kind of leaves the church in stages, in stages of his aging. Can you say something about those stages? What I hear you say is that you kind of left all at once, but the young man in your story had had various stages of separation from the church.
Well, it was a fairly long separation from the time I went to college and, you know, began to wake up to all of the ideas, you know, that were going on in the world. It lasted for about 3 or 4 years until I finally just could not support the church's ways.
I think that one of the things that struck me in this story was actually the conclusion. And this character in your story is an old man now, and he's standing on perhaps the deck of his back porch now, and he's thinking about the church and whatever else. I'm not sure whatever else he is thinking about. Maybe you can enlighten us. But the last line in the story is, "I want it back. I deserve it back." What is the "it" that he is referring to in this story, Jerry?
It was basically my own soul, you know, that I thought maybe I had lost it, and that I was shaking my fist at God, asking for it back.
Asking for the God of the church that you have now left. That doesn't sound like a good bargain to me.
I don't think it worked out so well.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And then there's another story called Reaching Out. And I was struck by this line. You have a beautiful description of Mary McGuire. And you say in the story about Mary McGuire, if you didn't have anyone else close to you in your life, if you had Mary, you'd be all right. What are you referring to, Jerry, in that wonderful, wonderful line?
Right. Yeah, well, Reaching Out is a true story about a college friend of mine whose apartment caught on fire in the Gramercy Park area. And it's how the parents, attempted to save their baby. Mary was a true and a wise and a delightful friend from college. She was honest and buoyant and full of fun. Mary was always politically active and with strong liberal views. And we were great friends for a very long time.
I was struck by her reflection and your reflection on Birmingham, Alabama. And you mentioned Bull Connor, and you mentioned the civil rights activity in the 60s in Birmingham. And Mary McGuire has some comments about Birmingham. Tell us about that portion of the story where I'll preempt you a little bit, where Mary, or at least the author, says they hate Birmingham, Alabama, particularly at this time during the 60s.
Right. Well, we did. We despised Birmingham for its anti-Black activities, and Bull Connor, as you mentioned, and his gang. And I think the most despicable thing that happened during the whole civil rights movement was the bombing of the teenage girls in the Birmingham church. It was horrific. It was something that we all despised, and we hated Birmingham for having produced the kinds of people who could, you know, who could torch, you know, teenagers. It was really pretty bad. But the point in the story that I was making was Mary was such a saintly type that she was ready to forgive those people, even though she, you know, she hated the, you know, the actions that they performed.
I want to read, Jerry, the comment that she made in that story. If you don't mind, talking about that hellhole, I hated Birmingham in the mid-60s. This is what you were saying. Bull Connor and his dogs, the Freedom Rider beatings, especially the bombing of the church girls, you say in the story, hated it for good reasons, but saintly Mary promoted peace and understanding. She said, you have to reach out to them, share in confronting their devils with an open heart and mind, and then you have to be prepared to forgive them.
Right. Well, that was just the kind of person, you know, she was. I have never been able to forgive those people for that bomb.
So you're not the saint that Mary McGuire
not by a long shot
was. Yeah, there's another story, Jerry, that I want to mention that again struck me as a significant story, and that's the story called Crystal Gazing. Tell us if you would about that story.
Right. One of my hobbies in those years was to become involved in the new art class movement. And I started a collection and I went to see the artists and visited all the galleries and got very much involved. It was my idea that maybe one of those pieces of glass had some miraculous portions to it. So what I did is I just used my imagination to try to take a piece of glass that would be a miracle worker, and that's pretty much how I followed up.
Well, tell us what happens. I mean, it's significance, the insight that comes out of this piece of crystal and the story around it.
Right. Well, what happens is it's a piece of glass that comes apart. And the protagonist in the story, a woman who's involved with the maintenance people on the east side, shared the splinter of glass that she discovered was able to improve people's medical condition. So it was like a healing piece of glass, and she would lend it out to her friends and they would use it, and they discovered that it was also a miraculous piece, but the piece was finally lost. So the miracle ended, but for a certain period of time, we had like a special piece of glass.
What was the object when all the pieces were together, Jerry? What was the art object that it created?
A kind of a ball, you know, maybe a softball size piece of art glass.
Well, I have to confess that in reading the story, I found it. And I don't know if I transposed this onto the story or not, but I found this as kind of a globe, and all of the pieces of the globe coming together. And when one of the pieces is lost, we have a real metaphor now for the kind of world that we're living with. So I kind of took it a little bit of a different direction, perhaps than you intended. But as a reader, I will I will hold to that that interpretation.
Anyway. Okay,
that's am I anywhere one. Near where you were?
Absolutely, absolutely right.
Let me turn to another story, mutual attraction. That I have to confess, Jerry, it's a very short short story. I have to confess that that comes off as sort of a feel-good story for me. And feel-good stories are fine. But also, I found some depth to this little feel-good story also. But tell us about mutual attraction.
Right. There are a couple of romantic stories in the collection, and this is one of them. It's about the spontaneous explosion of emotions between two people who were vague friends but didn't really know one another, but they come together and they have a vague positive view of each other, but suddenly, you know, wham! The hormones kick in. And they've become lovers.
Well, I like again the last line of the story. For me, the guy has a dream about her, and in that dream they become lovers, and so prompted by that dream. He says, well, I'm going to call her. So he chases down her phone number and he gives her a call. And Jerry, I think this is just an excellent line. She picks up the phone. He says who he is. And she responds, what took you so long?
Right. Well, I think that's the way it is. We have distant friends and we all wonder about, you know, how close we could really get to them. And I think this is one of the stories that reflects that sort of thing.
Well, it's serendipitous and really a good, story. Well, there's one other story that I know you have said is one of your favorites in the collection. What is that story, Jerry? And tell us about it.
It's called Fighting Lady, and it's about the aircraft carrier Yorktown and the Battle of Midway and Coral Sea. And it relates to flyers who are friends, two friends who get together 20 years after the war, and they're looking back, and they're with a couple of guys from the 60s generation. And it's a comparison between sort of those tough, steady, silent types of the 1940s, the Gary Cooper types, and the more ebullient, lively 1960s kids. And it was a comparison between the two generations, and I just found that that emotionally I was really totally involved in the creation of the story.
Jeff, what is the genesis of that story for you? How did you come to write Fighting Lady?
Well, it does have a long story. When I was 13 or 14 years old, it was during the war, and I followed carefully the exploits of the Pacific flyers, the carrier flyers, and the dauntless destroyers, and their fights against the Japanese fleets, and I was really taken with those battles as a kid, and I actually was able, with the help of my stepfather, to go into the offices of the New York Herald Tribune and get into the back issues and the archives from the newspaper to pull out the story. And what I did when I was 14 years old, I actually wrote a novel about the Fighting Lady. So it was something I've carried pretty much all my life, was this respect for these carrier pilots from World War II.
Well, it's an excellent story. Let me take you back, Jerry, to the beginning of our discussion and the piece I read about PX's saloon. Is PX's saloon, which, and I chose that to read because I thought it was so characteristic of New York and of the time that you're writing about, and of the sections of New York that your stories reflect and take place in. But PX's saloon had a rhythm of its own. I read there was the lunch crowd, the after work, the martini set, and so forth. I did not look it up, but is PX's a real saloon? And regardless, tell us about PX's saloon.
Right. It's really a representation of P.J. Clark's on 3rd Avenue, which was an old Irish bar from way back, which was sort of taken over by the advertising crowd. So that you had this wonderful combination of the old Irish neighborhood people and these sharp hipsters coming in from Madison Avenue. And it was a very lively place. And all the debutantes used to come in the evening with their long gowns, and mill around and talk to the guy sitting at the bar. It was a wonderful, and still is. It's P.J. Clark's is a great New York saloon, maybe one of the best.
Well, I thought it was representative of the times in which you were writing, and just a wonderful description of that bar and saloon and the activities that were taking place there. But Tommy Ryan, what are you familiar with Tommy Ryan? And who was the Tommy Ryan of the saloon that you're writing about?
No, I sort of made him up. I did myself have a little activity on a West Side Irish bar, and I sort of took my experiences from there and put them into the story. But there are community leaders all over New York, and he was the one from the Irish East Side.
Well, the unofficial mayor. And then you to some degree describe him as speaking to his parishioners. So Jerry, you may have left the church at some point, but like you said, the church never left you.
Right.
And I find a number of references, positive references to the church, like Tommy Ryan holding forth before his parishioners, and the choice of that language is excellent, I think. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one last question, Jerry. What kind of advertising did you sell in New York and other places?
Right, I pretty much stayed in the publishing business all my life, so I was selling advertising for a variety of magazines, and I was in that business for a long time, but I finally burned out when I was about 40. So I had to get off the street for 6 or 7 years. But then I went back to it after I sort of calmed down a little bit. But it was a lively business. It was Madison Avenue.
Well, it certainly fueled a great deal of your writing, and we can be very happy about that. I found, in fact, your writing a pleasure to read and impressive and fulfilling. Thanks again for joining me.
A pleasure. Morning. Thank you, Hal.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This is Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.